Hey everyone, in today's episode of The Depolarizers, I'm in conversation with Marshall Kozloff, who you may recognize as host of the Realignment Podcast. The Realignment Podcast covers the transformation of American politics in the wake of Donald Trump's 2016 victory. Marshall is also host of Arsenal of Democracy at the Hudson Institute and Horns of a Dilemma, a War on the Rocks Texas National Security Review podcast covering foreign policy. Marshall holds fellowships at the University of Texas at Austin, the Foundation for American Innovation, and the Niskanen Center. In addition to these roles, Marshall is the executive producer of Endless Frontiers, an upcoming National Competitiveness Summit in Austin, Texas, where he works as an entrepreneur in residence at America's Frontier Fund. Thanks for listening. Marshall, it's so nice to have you. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. I loved being on a panel with you. So we're kind of reversing roles here, but this is great.
Yes. For those who don't listen to Marshall on the pod, he has two amazing podcasts, at least. Those are two I know of. And he's always on the other side asking questions, giving great context. And so today I'm excited to interview the interviewer. So super excited to have you today. Speaking of those amazing podcasts, you have a podcast called The Realignment. Big fan of it. I love when you talk to our friend Steve Tellis. And we'll get into some of that later. But how do you define, or how did you even initially define realignment in the context of why you started your podcast? Maybe what events inspired it? And then maybe how has that changed over the past 5 years or so that you've been doing it?
Yeah, so the realignment referred to basically the post-2016 moment. I think I, along with everyone else who's interested in politics, woke up in November to a totally new world. Donald Trump's election wasn't at all something that I was prepared for. I don't think anyone else really was either. But him getting elected the way he got elected really represented a just total change in our political system. So I really wanted to build a show that bought into some of those changes, aka, wow, the Republican Party can talk to working class people in a way they didn't used to. Wow, Donald Trump has accepted things like Social Security, things like Medicare and Medicaid that Mitt Romney famously didn't. And then also critically, the realignment was really focused on the transformation of the Republican Party after the 2012 election and how the transformation didn't go the direction people would have thought. Because if you go back to 2013, in deep yesteryear, you had something called the Growth and Opportunity Project. This was the, wow, Mitt Romney surprisingly lost to Barack Obama, and he lost because he was going to say self-deportation. He lost because he couldn't speak to millennials. He lost because of social issues. So we as the Republican Party need to become more friendly to immigration. We need to pass comprehensive immigration reform. We need to nominate Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush. We have to do all these different things. And it turned out on basically every single count, Donald Trump did the opposite. And it actually worked. Now, it seemed like a bit of an aberration with 2020, but he obviously was just reelected again now. So this is very firmly there. And now, so the realignment for its first 5 years was very focused on the Republican Party. And now I'm really focused on the Democratic Party, because I think this year, this moment is basically the Democratic Party's equivalent of 2013. Just as in 2013, the Republican Party had all these different options and iterations and figures who could take power, Democrats are in the same space. You're going to start seeing the guest list. You know, the first guest on my show was J.D. Vance back in 2019. We're kind of seeing the show shift more to Democrats because, once again, this is the really interesting intellectual space.
Yeah. And even going into that a little bit, since we are now post-election, do you want to kind of discuss some of the realignments that you have seen take place that you think are, you know, maybe some things we've seen before and then some things that we're just now seeing in 2025 for the first time?
Yeah. So my line on this in the podcast is I'm frustrated that I thought Kamala Harris was going to win. I did predict that close to the actual November result. Because if you actually looked at what happened, every single thing that happened were things I'd talked about on the show. The collapse of Democrats in battleground states, the fact that American politics is increasingly polarizing around class and education, not necessarily race, the troubles Democrats were having with Latino voters, especially in places like South Texas, all of those issues were discussed on the show. So my joke to this is, you should still keep listening to The Realignment, because if you'd listen to The Realignment without listening to me as an interviewer, every single bit that actually happened was predictable. So yeah, let's focus on like the most important one, which is I had Patrick Ruffini on. He wrote this really great book called Party of the People. And when I had him on the show in 2023, I actually hadn't read the book, but I read the book over break. And one of the first lines in the book is, and this is a very, very important realignment theme, American politics is increasingly polarized around higher education. So whether or not you went to college or not is just the centerpiece. And if let's go to the South Texas example, I'm doing this from Austin, Texas, where I live. If we are going to look at a Latino male voter in South Texas, one of those swing counties that increasingly went to the right, I think the useful way we should think about these Latino voters in 2025, 26, and 27, and 28 isn't, okay, so they are Hispanic, therefore they're inclined to voting for Democrats. This is something we should take as a given, the whole emerging Democratic majority idea from 2002. We should instead say, hey, if this guy didn't go to college, if he isn't interested in going to college and he listens to alternative media, a pretty good chance he's going to be leaning to the right. So looking at his class and education identity rather than just his racial identity. And that's something that has just been a real blind spot for people who think about Democratic politics, because at the end of the day, so much of the wave at a liberal or a Democrat or a leftist thought about politics was just through, for very obvious and understandable reasons, race. Race was the way you should think about American politics after 1932, when FDR starts realigning Black people towards the Democratic Party away from the Republican Party as the party of Lincoln legacy. And so this is just a real shift here, and it's the most important one folks need to focus on.
Which I love. I spoke with Patrick and Rui on one of our first initial episodes of Depolarizers and had some of the similar conversation that you're speaking of that you guys had several years ago. And yeah, it's just, it's so intriguing how you're talking about these blind spots. It's like, you know, we can't just put somebody in flannel and give them a little grr and talk about economic populism and be like, you're going to win the middle of America. It's like, no, like, what are these blind spots that you're talking of? You know, you live in Austin. I actually, funny enough, lived in Austin earlier this year. And my husband and I just moved back to South Carolina, where we're from. So, you know, we get the normal Southern people, right? The normal Southern Democrats. What are some of these other blind spots that you think that inherently left populism just doesn't have, right? The people on the right, Trump and Trump World MAGA, they get it, right? They know how to win people over and talk to people in a compelling way. But there are some things that I think on the left that we are trying to do, but we may not necessarily actually be able to achieve if we don't approach it the right way. What are some of those blind spots that you were talking about?
Yeah, so I actually just did an episode with Senator Chris Murphy where I was doing this intellectual exercise of saying, okay, Senator Murphy, you're arguing that left populism is the answer because populism is the center of the American political scene right now. So I just played this exercise of like, okay, so I'm going to play J.D. Vance in my head. And I'm going to write down like what are the parts of right populism that are going to go against left populism. And this is where the blind spot comes in. So what right populism does just incredibly well, and let's listeners put aside your beliefs on policy. Let's just think about messaging and ideas. Right populism blends economic critiques with sociocultural critiques. So for example, I had a bullet point that was trade and industry. What's the right populist answer? The right populist answer, here's the economics part. The economics part is, look, Donald Trump wants to reshore American industry and get this job done. So he's going to raise tariffs. They're going to make the Chinese be paid for, and it's going to be fine, even if the prices go up for a bit here, because we're going to have an American industry again, and that's going to be great. And we're going to deregulate everything left, right, and center at the federal level. So that's the economic argument. But the other part of their answer also is, and you know how we're going to get a workforce that's actually going to do these things? We're going to stop making everyone go to college. We're going to do the dirty jobs thing. We're going to focus on apprenticeships. We're going to stop saying that the answer to making America better is sending young men to waste 4 years of their life getting a BA degree from some no-name university they don't want to go to in the first place. So that is both an economic critique, an economic case in terms of reshoring America, making you feel good about yourself. But it's also saying, hey, you know how you also are skeptical of college because we have this college divide? We think that like this isn't about giving you more money to go to college. This isn't about saying, hey, we're going to make public education free. We're saying, why do you want to go in the first place? And that's if we just think about messages we hear. I spend a lot of my time in an independent media world, and just like you can't read too much in the comments, but the number of people who just react well to this idea that college is dumb, college doesn't make sense, college is a waste of time. I was joking that before this episode, my brother-in-law, he, you know, went to Clemson, South Carolina, shout out. And, you know, he's sort of doing his computer science degree and figuring things out. And my mother-in-law is always saying, like, why did you even go to college in the first place? You should have just gotten an HVAC license and then become a millionaire doing a small business like that way. that is a critique that the J.D. Vance thing speaks to versus the left populist or the generic left populist approach that we tried during the Biden administration, which is basically saying, hey, college is crazy expensive. You have debt. So we're going to offer to have your student loans forgiven, or we're going to make college free for you. If people don't want to go to college in the first place, that isn't as appealing of a pitch to you. And it's going to basically sound like, oh, this is about forgiving the student loans of people who aren't you and basically making you pay for it. Or they're saying you should do this thing you don't want to do in the first place. So that is just like a real blind spot. And then the other real blind spot too is really just around, like, let's say, let's focus on, for example, like the arguments around going against big industry. So another example was like, what is the right populist critique of industry? Because I should start with the left populist one. The left populist one is like, look, we need to talk more about billionaires and we need to talk more about corporations, how they are screwing everyone over. I pointed this out to Senator Murphy on our podcast. We tried greedflation in 2022. Like, what was the immediate response to the start of the inflation debacle during this administration? There was aggressive messaging around the idea that this was greedy corporations getting together in ways that like raised prices. So I need to clarify that I'm not even making a policy critique here, because I sort of spent a lot of time in like liberal left, like antitrust world. There were concrete examples, especially in the meatpacking industry, of like actual antitrust collusion that led to an increase in meat prices. So this isn't about like what did or didn't happen. But did the greedflation message break through? Was that what people were really interested in? No, it wasn't interesting. Chris Murphy pointed out that like these things like take time. So his sort of pitch for the Democratic Party is a Democratic Party that makes this pitch for the next few years. But my sort of response to this problem is, the problem is left populism isn't existing in a vacuum. So it's not this question of, okay, insert greedy corporations and billionaires making everything bad. It's this reality of the right pitch is going to be, sure, billionaires suck. That's a thing. That happens. We don't like Wall Street either. But actually, it's Joe Biden and his massive spending bills that caused this problem. And the test that we've had run over the past 2 years that left populism had no answer to is that with even within this working class identity group that we're talking about in the first place, which is more compelling? Greedflation or, hey, out of touch old Joe Biden and his friends are spending all this money that made the debt go really high and made inflation go really high? That is just much, much, much more compelling. So once again, like there's this real, my sort of critique when you read a lot of these sort of left populist manifestos that come out after the election, they're very interesting. We should really engage with them. You have to deal with ideas that aren't your own. It's just they really sort of treat left populism kind of like a talisman. Like, okay, so like deploy universal healthcare, deploy free college, deploy universal labor participation, and not understanding that there's just like very little proof that this stuff doesn't work in the first, the stuff is just not as appealing enough in the first place. And the last part of this, right, is I think the left populists overuse, have a blind spot for polling. They are way, way, way too focused on the fact that from an empirical perspective, like no one's telling lies here, if you poll Americans on left populist positions, they're going to have a majority. So during my research for the Chris Murphy episode, I read a Tyler Austin Harper from the Atlantic piece profiling him, and the piece pointed out, if you ask Americans, should we have government-sponsored healthcare? Should there be paid sick leave? Should there be free public college? Should we go after regulating big tech, big industry, pharma, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? These hold strong, strong, strong majority positions. So the obvious question, if we're not going to allege that this is all just purely corruption, because I don't think that's true, I think that's purely a cope answer, the actual answer is voters can think and respond yes to a questionnaire, but it's missing the sociocultural angle of that lens. Because if these were, my actual belief is that if 70% of Americans wanted universal free public college and they actually held that as a top priority, student debt forgiveness would have been much, much, much more of a political win than it actually was. This suggests that we should go a level or two deeper beyond the polls. And once again, because the left populists are frustrated about being out of power, the strongest evidence they have are these poll results, but I think they're totally, totally, totally over-exaggerating the impact and like the realities that they're living in.
100%. You said a lot of good stuff there. Namely, much love to your brother-in-law, but go Gamecocks. I'm just kidding. So kind of going into that a little bit, I really like what you were talking through just now. And you said on one of your episodes, I think it actually was with Steve, we're going to talk about abundance now, because I feel like there's a natural kind of migration here in the thought products here. And I think that one of your quotes was taking the framework of abundance and like inserting it as a layer of software over your analysis of political problems, which I love how well you put that. That was really nicely put. Why do you think that is the like appropriate application of abundance and abundance ideology instead of like these kind of full-throated political movements that we may be seeing even in the context of populism on either side? And we can get into more of like the specific of what abundance is, because I do want to make sure we're not just glossing over the fact that everyone knows what that is. But just curious on your thoughts on that as well.
Yeah. So just from a self-awareness perspective, I know referring to software and hardware is cringe. I do a decent amount of work in like the tech industry. So I know to a lot of listeners, that's going to sound very like off-putting, but here's what I really mean by that. So like, let's just start with this idea of like, we're all political actors. We think about politics. When we are going throughout our lives and thinking about voters and problems and just the country as a whole, because I think it's very important that you understand your country. One of my favorite quotes is De Gaulle, you know, the famous French leader from the 20th century, said like, I have a certain idea of France. And when I'm looking at political candidates, especially during a realignment moment where everything's shifting, like, I am searching for a candidate who has a certain idea of America right now, and then are using that to build upon rather than sort of operating in the like in reverse, which is what you tend to see from too many people. So let's talk about the software layer. So if you talked to any, let's say, so two areas we're talking about. So let's talk about the 2000s. So like when I'm in high school, when I'm youth governor of Oregon, I go to Boys Nation, I'm on the youth city council, I'm very much like this, like, politician, like try hard, wants to be most likely to be president in my high school class kid. During that period, and I bring this up not to sort of do an annoying politician humble brag, but just sort of say like, I remember what it was like to think about the world. And the software layer that existed there was basically, wow, it's the era of hope and change. Our job is to pass big legislation that makes things happen. So Obama's coming in and we're going to pass Wall Street reform. We're going to pass universal healthcare. We're going to just do these things. We're going to pass big legislation. We are there to basically recognize that the country is going to be this progressive future in 2050. And our job is through legislation to make us reach closer and closer and closer to the goal. So like, that is what we woke up thinking our job was in our actual period. So then the 2010s happen and populist backlash starts. You see Occupy Wall Street, you see all these different issues. The software layer, sort of like the approach or even the glasses that we're starting to change, like, wow, like actually America isn't this sort of emerging democratic majority, like happy place, everything's getting better. This isn't just about like passing bills and legislation. There's income inequality. There is a gap between the rich and poor. And actually, if we look at what Obama did, it didn't get at that enough. And actually, it turns out Obama gets a lot of support from Wall Street. And actually, it turns out that we didn't jail anyone from the 2008 financial crisis. And actually, during the Bill Clinton 1990s, corporations and growth and dynamism and tax cuts really sort of made a bunch of people win, but it didn't make everyone win. So we're going to think of every single political issue through the lens of income inequality. And once again, not just every single political issue, but our actual political frame. So what is Bernie Sanders and his pitch to the American people? His pitch is America is the land of income inequality. We are going to conduct a political revolution to take over the Democratic Party and center our political pitch around the people versus the powerful, the 99% versus the 1%. That is sort of the underlying idea here. What frustrates me about that layer of analysis isn't really just like the policy one. It's just that if you actually look at what happened over the next few years, that was very, very unhelpful when it came to Democratic candidates thinking about how they actually win elections and actually govern. So because everyone's thinking of income inequality in the 2010s, what did the Democratic campaign in 2019 during the primary turn into? Putting aside social issues, think of how much time in the debates was spent getting nitty gritty about the specific nature of universal healthcare plans and this thing versus that thing. Guess what? Didn't matter at all during the 2020 campaign. Did Joe Biden have a universal healthcare plan? No, because Joe Biden, and this is the frustration of Joe Biden, I think, lost the sort of political ball. I think his idea of what America was invalid after, let's say, February 2021. But that said, I think he totally got the dynamic of the country. He was like, whoa, there's all this chaos. People want things to feel chill. They want things to be normal. So he wasn't focused on what's my most left pushing social policy? What's my most left pushing progressive economic transformation? It was just basically, I'm normal. I've been in Washington. I'm not going to have chaos in the White House. I'm not doing all this crazy stuff. I'm just straightforward Joe Biden. He really got that. So just starting off every single question from, oh, wow, how do I be most economically left populist to deal with this income inequality issue really misled people. So then this gets to your actual question. What is abundance and why do I think abundance is like the proper layer that you should actually think around? So several things. So number one, like what is the abundance agenda? So the abundance agenda, I know it doesn't quite like roll off the tongue for people, but Derek Thompson and Ezra Klein have an upcoming book on the topic of abundance. It comes out this March. I really recommend people check it out. But Derek started writing about abundance in 2022 in The Atlantic. And the basic idea is it starts with a critique of the status quo in the United States, which is critical, critical, critical. And the critique is like, hey, if we just go through the list of actual real problems that people are having, especially at a generational level, what do they rhyme with? They are basically, hey, everything costs too much, which is perfect for post-inflation politics. College costs too much. Housing costs too much. Basic cost of living costs too much. If you actually talk to actual voters, are voters talking about, well, you know, I'm really looking for like Medicare for all. I really am looking for like this very, no, they're actually saying like everything just costs too much. And it's very, very, very important that we note that basically Democrats did not have a canned articulation of what you're basically trying to do here. And if you could go back in time, if you'd had the abundance agenda at the start of the agenda from the start, what you could have had is a situation where you basically said at the start of the presidency, hey, America costs too much. Everything's too expensive. We are the people who think that everything costs too much and we're going to wake up and spend 18 to 20 hours a day actually fixing that. So therefore, when things go bad, when prices go up, when there is a supply chain crisis that increases prices, people already built into the idea that you're the one who are already focused on this. So the thing about Donald Trump is, let's say there is a border migration surge during the Trump presidency. My bet is that Trump is not going to be hit by that issue the same way Joe Biden was, because voters are already going to have the frame of like, oh man, we're worried about this border surge. Thank God we elected the person who's thinking about addressing this issue in the first place. So abundance is all about basically saying like, start with your point that if we actually get away from like the big ideas and the theory and post-neoliberalism and the end of the New Deal order, no, it's basically everything costs too much. Start there and go from there. And what's also great about the abundance agenda is it's something that the left should like really be interested in, because it should be tied to another big idea that I'm really interested in, which is this question of state capacity. So there's the abundance agenda, there's then state capacity, which is a part of the abundance agenda, which is basically, to what degree can the American state, the government, deliver these things they want to actually deliver? So if we want clean energy, if we want clean energy to be abundant and available for everyone, that's the abundance idea, right? Like the Democratic pitch should not be like, oh, like we're going to raise everyone's electricity prices because that's the way we solve climate change. The pitch is, hey, we want a clean economy where there's an EV battery charging station for your plug-in electric hybrid, which works for everyone. And we have a mix of natural gas. And of course, there's some oil because people still have normal cars. And there's always like basic different things. The problem is if you just talk about abundance like that without articulating, oh, and here's how we actually make the American state capable of delivering that abundance, the whole project falls apart. Because the problem with the Biden administration is they were like, okay, we're the government of high-speed rail. We're the government of EV battery charging stations. We're the government of clean power and the electric power transition. But what they couldn't do is translate that into real-world actual outcomes. The famous example that went really viral was Pete Buttigieg won on ABC News, where he was confronted with the fact that like despite billions of dollars of allocation for EV battery charging stations, only 7 or 8 of them were built. And the defense of that was, well, look, like that was allocated by 2030 and they hadn't spent all the billions of dollars yet. But once again, if your pitch to the American people is we are the people who could build a cheap, clean energy future that you're going to want to live in, you have to be able to deliver things much, much faster than that. And then the last one that's really key here too is this is where abundance meets state capacity. Let's focus on the rural broadband delivery debacle. So you had a situation where $42 billion was spent to provide rural broadband to rural America. So on paper, this is like the perfect post-Trump Democratic Party policy pitch, which is basically, hey, we totally get that in 2016, we got shellacked and learned our lesson. We were too focused on the coast. We were too focused on the big cities. We were too like culturally out of touch. So we are going to deliver specific results that Donald Trump did not deliver in 2016. Well, one of those results were, we're going to pass $42 billion of legislation to deliver rural broadband. Basically, none of it got built. So you had an abundance idea, aka we're going to have a country where everyone has access to high-speed internet and could experience all the benefits of Zoom or Riverside like we're doing here, or just like work from home, all these different things. But then they couldn't actually build it. So you deeply have to be concerned with it. So my last bit on this kind of rant here is that my real frustration is that we get to tribal within a coalition. So there's like the centrist ideas. And right now, like abundance and state capacity are very centrist coded. But I want the left to be interested in state capacity specifically, because like, let's talk about a state capacity issue when it comes to healthcare. How much was Obamacare set back by the healthcare.gov debacle? The government's inability to have the healthcare portal up and ready literally led to years of delay, but also really negative parties in response to this. So if you're a Democrat on the like left populist side and you think the answer is like single payer healthcare, Medicare for all, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the idea that the American state right now is up for that without like a debacle, healthcare.gov times 20, which would then provoke another midterm backlash, which would set the project further and further and further, I think you're not paying attention to the actual issue here. So I think everyone should be interested in this question of, if we want the American state to do something for actual people, are we actually confident it can do that actual thing? And not enough people are interested in that question.
Yeah, they're not. And I really love your just emphasis on things being more tangible, right? Like the proof is in the pudding, and we also don't want the pudding to cost $1 zillion, right? And I feel like one of the biggest failures of the party, the left this past cycle particularly, was like just not being proven trustworthy, right? To your point on all those things that you just laid out, like we need to be proven more trustworthy that we can deliver and provide things that are not just, elusive and holistic, like, oh, we're going to make democracy more pretty, like whatever, who cares about that, right? Like we need to talk about things that are actually tangible for people. So kind of in that vein, and I really like this abundance track that we're on here too. I guess maybe what is in your mind the perfect concoction of democratic ideals from progressives, from centrists, abundance folks that you think could actually build a robust coalition and also provide these like tangible pieces of evidence in delivering that, you know, actually kind of creates this bulwark against this Republican right populism that we're seeing, particularly because Republicans are becoming increasingly attractive as a party, particularly for lots of different voters of different backgrounds.
Yeah. So I did some, as I referenced with the Patrick Ruffini Party of the People book, I did a lot of reading over the break just to sort of get my mind right for 2025. And one of the books that no one has actually read recently that I actually read was The Emerging Democratic Majority, which was the Roy Teixeira, John B. Judas book. And what was so helpful about it is that it actually included a line towards the end that no one ever cites. It says, look, there are all these debates about the future of the Democratic Party. Are we going to be more centrist? Are we more left? End of the day, we should recognize that politics is actually about synthesis. There's never any one faction that ever actually wins. Even we sort of like read back on Bill Clinton winning in 1992, and we said to ourselves, like, look, he was the DLC, New Democrat, centrist guy. Like, no, like, he actually campaigned. He had that. But he also campaigned like very, very, very aggressively populist. And one of his first acts was a failed healthcare effort. But once again, that was what got him elected there. So we should just note that it's not a choice over whether we're more left or more centrist. Like actually some coalition that's going to merge these things together are going to be really, really critical. So here's what we sort of talked a bit of smack about the left here. Let's start with something that I've really learned from the left over the past few weeks. And this is going to be slightly rude to some listeners of your show. I think in my focus on policy disagreements with people like Bernie Sanders, I sort of took things too literally and not seriously. And what Bernie, when I look back at 2015, 2016 Bernie, when I think he was most politically effective, is he was just so aggressively anti-status quo and very specifically like anti-Democratic National Committee and anti the people who run things in DC. And I really heard that. I really felt this when I was sort of, so on a couple of levels. One was just personal. So like I was, you know, on Instagram over break, and I was watching all of the sort of like, you know, these people, DC people, both big name and no name, sort of going to the White House Christmas party and getting their big photos with Joe Biden and looking super cool and getting the right selfie. And I'm sort of like, oh man, like, you guys kind of suck. Like, you guys are incompetent. You guys are clearly doing this weird inside baseball DC signaling game. I know you personally. I know you're not really interested in ideas. I think you're going to go off and work in government relations at some company for 4 years until you go back in to the next Democratic administration, just sort of keep that thing going. I'm like, I felt viscerally angry at these people in a way that I'd never really felt before. And that is the critique that Bernie Sanders, I think at his core, is making. And frankly, I think much, much more of an important critique than his universal healthcare bitch. I think more people resonated with the idea of his disgust of DC and how things were actually done. And this is what led to some of the confusion during the 2020 primary, which was people weren't glomming onto him. Like those Obama-Trump swing voters who then also were interested in Bernie, they weren't going to him because he had the perfect Medicare for All plan. That was a kind of a way that he signaled how anti-status quo he was. But they're really driven by that. I think the center left needs to get way, way, and this is going to be super hard, way, way, way more comfortable with like, no, like, not just DC, but actually our team, our institutions, our consulting class. I think a lot of people started to feel this when they were watching like the Kamala Harris loss episode. So the episode of Pod Save America where the Biden Harris campaign folks are coming on and giving these very like focus group tested answers. And they're like, well, we were technically doing it, and no one liked it. I'm like, that's the energy you kind of really, 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 really need there. So I think that from the future, like we just really have to start with, they are just so right on that. And it's easy to dismiss when we focus on how they then apply that. Cause like kind of like the Bernie left populist answer is, yeah, you're right, Marshall, the status quo DC does suck. That's why we needed to do this laundry list of like deliverist, like left populist responses. And I'm not going to agree with that, but I am going to agree if like just the energy is so, 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 so needed. But here's where, once again, where I think the actual like center left comes in, which is I think right now operationally, because the center left is in a position where we're sort of focused not just on the economic side of things, but also on the sociocultural one, what we actually have is this reality that like, hey, actually the American people are not voting just on what economic benefits are you pitching to them on the stump. Like that is something that really should be disproven during the 2024 election. So I think the center left part of the coalition can understand here is like, hey, actually there's this sociocultural aspect to what J.D. Vance at his best is speaking to that we have to talk to about too. So if I were a Democratic candidate, I would not think that if I were going to like South Carolina, so like North South Carolina, if I were like in like the parts of like Latino Texas campaigning, I wouldn't campaign on free college. I would actually campaign. My funny sister soldier moment wouldn't be sort of like quote unquote throwing trans people under the bus or like talking about wokeness or Latinx. I would actually say like, hey, too many Democrats are obsessed with sending you all to college. I think that's actually really dumb. I actually think that like most of you should be able to pursue whatever you want to pursue. So guess what? If you don't want to go to college, we should live in an economy where you can just graduate from like a competent, effective high school and get like a great job that's going to put you on a real path. There's lots of stuff we can do with that. If you want to get an apprenticeship, like that's awesome. Let's start working on these like really wonky, but super interesting. Like I've read about some of these and I've had guests on, like there are some programs that get you started in an apprenticeship when you are 15, 14 years old in high school. So you don't have to have that like direct to college option. I would focus on like those dynamics. I would also say that like, once again, this is where I was talking about abundance and actual state capacity. So I'd really focus on like the empiric side of the thing, which is basically saying like, to what degree can we actually deliver things? So there's this weird dynamic where you're going to have a synthesis of left anti-status quo politics in a way that makes people super, super uncomfortable, which I'm only capable of. And people sort of, it's funny, my version of this is like, people always ask me, dude, like move back to DC. Like, you know, you should like be in DC to do the work you do. But like, obviously like I'm in Austin, Texas, as you know, like Austin is like a very, very like blue, very like metropolitan city. But just, I will just tell you, like being in Texas in general and thinking of a Texas POV is super helpful when it comes to sort of like getting that. So I will not be moving back to DC, no matter what my bosses at various think tanks I work at tell me. But it's really just sort of merging these things together. So it's really just like, once again, the anti-status quo of the left, but also just like the realization that economics is not purely the way forward that the voters were actually talking to.
Lots there. I don't even know where to start. That was so good. I mean, just off the ending there, I am a lifelong learner and always intend to be, but one of my superpowers, I feel like, is living in South Carolina, not in DC. that is how you stay connected to reality. And I do, you know, fundamentally believe that a lot of what you're just talking about is so true. It's like, you know, people get frustrated with, you know, people thinking that, oh, Democrats are just in DC for the funsies and the selfies. They're not actually getting any work done. And some of what they're saying is legit. We need to reckon with that. So kind of going off of what you were just saying a second ago about, you know, just like your several years of conversations with great political minds, great innovators, technology folks, et cetera. What have been, I think, some of your maybe takeaways from your conversations over the past 5 years that you think are really applicable now? And you can name drop people if you feel led to, but, you know, just kind of curious about, like, you know, you've been studying this, you've been studying the realignment, right? Like, yeah, what are your prescriptions here?
Yeah. And I've got a cool job because, and I'm fascinated by structure. So the realignment is supported by a nonprofit. I get grant funding. So I just do whatever I want to do in terms of topics. If I were doing this purely in like a profit oriented direction, the show would be like one very different version of the show, but it is like, the funny thing is like the more viral episodes go, like the less useful they are. And some of my most useful episodes have been one that aren't viral. So like my real, and by the way, like, and this is like a real warning to people, and this is just a quick side note, but, okay. So this is actually a real lesson I've learned here. Alternative media is so dangerous. And I think so many Democrats are setting themselves up for failure with this stuff. So think about it this way. So think of like your most legacy mainstream media, CBS, ABC, NBC, PBS. We're talking 60s, 70s before cable TV exists. That era, especially when the New York Times and the Washington Post were at their peak, that era was an era that just sort of was balanced structurally towards center left and left politics. People who went into those professions tended to be liberal. Those institutions had the most power. And it meant that, like, if you wanted to go into media, you just had to go there and you had to recognize that there was a real bias there. Well, the same thing exists today, but in the other direction. So, for example, when alternative media has a real right wing bias to it, and something that everyone's kind of noticed is that, like, Joe Rogan, Lex Friedman, all of the comedians who get really big on YouTube, but if you actually listen to what they're saying, their thought is very, very, very right wing. And I want to be very precise here because I was talking to someone from this organization called American Compass. They're a right populist group. And he was asked what conservatism is. And he said, well, we need to break this up into three different things to make this very clear. There's the Republican Party. There is the conservative movement. And there are right wingers. So what I don't like is when people are like, oh man, Joe Rogan's such a Republican, or Joe Rogan's such a conservative now. He's not. He's not a Republican. He likes current Republican elected officials, but he does not identify with the GOP, nor should he. Secondly, he's not a conservative. He definitely doesn't have hawkish views on foreign policy. He's definitely open to some like left populist ideas that are conservative, but he is right wing. He's anti-establishment, anti-status quo in ways that clearly, clearly, clearly are animated, not by economics. He's not the Joe Rogan who's obsessed with Bernie Sanders talking about universal healthcare. He's a Joe Rogan who wakes up thinking wokeness is out of control, crime is out of control, all these liberal elites who control our structure and our society are bad and they need to be beaten. Having that POV makes you right wing. And part of what happens here is that the YouTube algorithm, for a variety of reasons, I'm not alleging conspiracy here, trends towards that direction. Whenever I have episodes that like trend in that direction, they're always the most right wing episodes. The left stuff doesn't play well. With center left stuff really doesn't play well. So once again, it's important that I have a platform. It's premised on me getting paid to do smart, interesting conversations that like 5,000 people at a minimum find very useful, not like, did this go viral? So I think a lot of people, because you're seeing all this discourse about Democrats need to sort of engage in this alternative media infrastructure the Republicans have like always thrived in and conservatives have thrived in. They need to understand that like, while that is true, if they go into this and take it too literally, they will end up being captured. So, and you know, I'm not going to try to. Let me give you a perfect example of this. So, for example, I'm a friend of Rokana. I like Rokana. I really respect his efforts to like talk to people in this infrastructure. But he went on Breaking Points of Crystal Ball a few weeks ago, And Crystal Ball, who is, you know, she's on the left, she was critiquing Elon Musk and all the billionaires that kind of exist there. Ro was like, well, you know, Democrats have way more billionaires supporting them, Republicans support them. The question that Ro Khanna should be asking himself is articulating that point going to push people to the left, or is it going to push them in a nihilist direction to the right? If nothing matters, if everyone's bought and paid for, another example, and this is one that Democrats need to be really, really careful with, because I actually agree with them. I agree that members of Congress stock trading is just like, it's just such a bad look. I think it's such a bad look. And I think it's like super unproductive when members defend it. The executive branch has very, very strident requirements that like Congress doesn't have. They should basically be the same. I don't care if they are literally corrupt. This is one of those like politics is about like the idea of things, not the literal things. I don't think Nancy Pelosi is congressional stock trading based on inside information. This is like literally not true, but it doesn't matter. Like we're in a populist anti-status quo moment. Center left and center right people who like think it's unfair that they're underpaid, which I think members of Congress are, need to just accept this is something you're giving up. Sorry, Nancy Pelosi, you're just not going to be able to do this. Sorry, Dan Crenshaw gets particularly like vituperative when people go after him for it. You're going to have to give this one up. But all that said, when Democrats play with that fire, they don't understand the actual message that's being sent here. So when a Democrat goes on Breaking Points and says, yeah, Crystal, yeah, Sagar, I agree with you. The congressional stock trading stuff is out of control. It's so corrupt. It's so bad. What is the actual message? If you actually look on the comments, you actually look what people are actually saying. And I went on a bunch of live tours of Breaking Board. So I've actually talked to people about this. The message isn't this wonky technocratic, my version, which is, yeah, well, I get a minimum. If I were in Congress, my bill would make the congressional stock trading rules the same as the executive branch, which would basically knock out the status quo. That's the wonky technocrat response. But if you actually look at the comments, what are people actually saying? They're actually saying, man, Tinkerbell DC, it's all fake. These people are bought and paid for. None of them have good ideas. They're sharing inaccurate, you know those websites that like estimate people's net worth? They're like super not real. They'll share like AOC is now worth $25 million. Where'd she get that from? She got it from congressional stock trading. That is exactly the sort of thought that leads someone down a nihilistic right-wing pipeline. So like, once again, the thing you have to be able to do as a Democrat is going into this right-wing space is understand this is going to lead people. If you pure play to the algorithm and pure play to like what's going to get you the most views, it's going to lead you to a bad direction. It's going to be actually unhelpful. So what I think you really need to do is basically start with like, okay, this is just a right-wing space. In the same way that when John McCain would go on SNL, he's like, oh yeah, this is like a left-wing space, right? Like Republicans didn't seriously say, we need to build like a right-wing version of SNL or we need to build a right-wing version of CBS in the 1970s. They just understood that like there are views here. This is where the audience is. Like we need to go into that space. But at their best, they were still rooted in their actual thoughts. So what they should be rooted in is, yeah, Joe Rogan, I'm going to come off and say, hey, Joe, I think you think the DC is like super cynical, but guess what me and all my young millennial Democratic buddies have done? We've all come together and we too want to pass a congressional stock ban. And anyone who doesn't support that, screw them. Boom. But then you have to move on to the positive side of the ledger because it's so easy. And if you listen, if you as a host and the listeners like listen to when like members go on these alternate media podcasts, it's just a cascade of negativity and nihilism and thought that operationally leads someone to being right wing. Like there's this whole joke about like, why are all these left populists who were like left populists in the 2010s going full MAGA? It's because once again, the space they're in is nihilistic. And once again, if DC is all fake, if everyone is all corrupt, if everyone's just like woke in bad faith, the actual logical endpoint isn't a Bernie left populist revolution. It's right wing, burn the system down, MAGAism. And that's what people need to be very, very careful for. So that's like, I've just given like a big rant, so I'll stop there. But I just like, this is the thing that like really triggers me because like very few people have, I'm one of the only, because like I do some work for PBS, right? Like I work at a think tank, but I also do alternative media and I also host an independent podcast. I'm one of the few people in these spaces who's actually spent time in all of them. And it's come to understand like, and I think I'm one of the people who made the affirmative choice. Oh, this is like a bad idea. It'd be really, like, so for example, after January 6th, like Sagar and I had Eric Weinstein from the Intellectual Dark Web on, did super, 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 super well. If I wanted to be like my most peak famous, I would just do that every single week. What you would find is if I did that more and more and more, I'd very clearly be on the like, I'm an IDW right-wing person. The Free Press is not my favorite publication. And actually, like, the Dems are blank, 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 blank. So just staying rooted is so key.
Perception's reality. You know, if you have to, you know, continually work at your relationships and remind loved ones and friends that you do care about them and all that sort of stuff, like, you know, what expectation do people have of their members of Congress? Like, you have to remind them that you're to be trusted, right? I think that, again, building trust and cultivating a relationship with the American people is something that Democrats can do. It's just a matter of will. I know we're getting pretty high on time. I didn't realize how long we've been talking.
This is what happens when your guest decides to rant as an interview host. Dude, I have a voice in my head being like, chop it up.
I'm all about a good rant, man. I'm all about a good rant. Okay, I think I'm going to ask you last two questions and then we can hop. So going back to kind of what you're saying about alternative media, blah, 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 people are like, oh, we need to make a left Rogan. But I'm like, but you're not, your fave could never, right? It's not happening. Say all that to say, what elements do you think a centrist ecosystem needs to thrive and not only thrive to engage voters, but actually inspire them? Like, maybe it's not necessarily media focus only, but like, what are some of these elements that you think the center would need?
Yeah. So what the center really needs to do is the center needs to start with its critique that the status quo DC system is broken. And to what degree can the center bring in outside people? Like, here's the thing about J.D. Vance. Like, back in 2011, 2012, J.D. Vance was a random blogger at David Frum's like blog. Like, that was something he did. Like, no one knew who he was. And like, very, very, very rapidly. And I think Tim Walz discovered this like about 2 minutes into the VP debate, where like there was the idea of J.D. Vance. He basically thought he was doing with the J.D. Vance of 2021, who was saying weird things, who was saying dumb things, who was going on cat lady rants, who was clearly very angry. And he didn't recognize that J.D. Vance is clearly actually like very, very, very smart. And knowing J.D. Vance, knowing a lot of politicians, I would actually wager J.D. is like one of the only politicians I've ever met who like I actually learned things from. And not in the sense that like I'm Marshall, like this genius, but just that like most politicians just like are very talking points focused and they don't read books. Like, no, JD reads books. JD's very, very smart. And Tim Walz started getting very bug-eyed when he realized like, oh, wait, like, and he started doing this. Remember, he was sort of like, oh, that's a good point, JD. That's when you knew it was just totally cooked in that debate. Cause like JD Vance just like knows way, 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 way more than it. To what degree can the centrists find JD Vance people? Because those JD Vance people, because this is something I learned from spending all this time on the right, like the right was very good about elevating JD. JD gets a think tank fellowship at AEI. JD gets support to launch a nonprofit. JD gets all these different things. And so that's very, very frustrating. And second, like, I think the weirdest, because I spent all this time on the right, the weirdest thing that I've discovered about like center left spaces is how idea free they are. It's like really, 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 really weird. And this is a funny diploma divide. And I think this is actually a result of the diploma divide. So if you look at the right, there are so many academic programs where like you can get paid to read Tocqueville. You could get paid to debate the thought of Christopher Lash. You could get paid to debate these realignment projects as like a high school person. And the funding exists because there are all these like big Republican donors who are like, oh yeah, like our existing institutions that like are centered on elites, they basically only serve like left people if you're a university campus. So we're going to build our own existing infrastructure to elevate ideas. And that just doesn't exist on the left. It's really funny. Like, as I did more of these programs, I started getting all these LinkedIn messages from all these like left, center left kids who are like, hey, like, I saw you did this program, but like, I listened to the realignment and you seem pretty like centrist. So like, why don't these programs exist for me? Why aren't there spaces that like take ideas seriously? Because like, once again, this is just like my real depressing thing. And this is where like a lot of my anger at like the Christmas party crowd in DC came from. Like, I've just found weirdly enough that like of that top 20% of like Republican staffers, your top 20% Republican LC in the House, your legislative correspondent, is more interested in ideas, books, et cetera, than like your average Democrat. Even in that top 20%, I think it's a real failure because that doesn't matter during straightforward status quo era. So like, that doesn't matter if the year is 2010 or 2009 and all you're trying to do is like get Obamacare in the exact right shape. That does matter when American politics got reset in 2025. And what I will tell you is the people I know from J.D. Vance world, they have a very concrete, very like aggressive like interpretation of this political moment. They have an idea of what America is and they are going to have, and that's derived through thought versus people who just sort of swing left and right. In one moment, Kamala's anti pro busing, but then she's not. It's because she wasn't rooted. It's because she, like most center left people, is not actually rooted in ideas and philosophy and those dynamics beyond, like, our job is to, like, do the thing that sounds most, like, comfortably democratically centrist. And that's not going to work in this moment.
Yeah. Going back and forth is so unappealing and unattractive in candidates. And, you know, not to get into that because we are almost out of time. Okay. Last question. And also, like, one note, let Marshall rant more. Like, I think that should be a thing in 2025. More Marshall rants. We want more Marshall rants. Big fan of that.
The quick note before you call us for time is basically that the reason why I don't rant on the podcast is, like, the realignment works because, like, I'm just a friendly interviewer and I just talk to everybody. So I was at an event where someone was like, I almost introduced you as one of, like, the fellow conservatives because you're always, like, so polite and straightforward. So I think I if I ranted, I would not get as much of a bipartisan guest list. So yeah, please go on.
I'm going to bring you back to welcome stuff just so you can have your rant space. It's a free space for you, my friend. Okay, last question that we ask every guest, and thank you again for being here, is what is one depolarizing activity that listeners can partake in so that we can help depolarize our politics?
Basically, and I'm speaking to, like, real, like, centrist, center-left people, really just in an America where Donald Trump won a majority, just drop all of, like, super MAGA and maggots and, like, all of those, like, all just like, drop that language. I was reading a book by a senator that this episode's coming out, so people know what I'm speaking about. And it was about their career. And it's, like, really interesting. Then every few paragraphs, there'd just be a reference to super MAGA and the MAGA people. And it's just, like, it's exhausting. It's exhausting. I know what he was saying, but if I were a book reviewer, just drop it. And it was clearly written before the election. I think this book was premised on, like, Donald Trump might not coming back. But I really think that, like, focusing away, just basically not starting, because look, like, a third to, like, two-fifths of the country could be described as MAGA. And that is just, like, not a starting point for a functioning politics. So I just, like, just really, whenever you see people, and I did not do this on the episode because we only had 30 minutes, but when you see people in your network who, like, work in these spaces start to talk that way, just, like, just drop it. It's not necessary. It's not helpful. It doesn't help you think through problems. Really drop it. And then I'll give you a second one real quick to, like, make this actually more useful beyond just telling people what not to do. Really engage seriously, like, with the right. Actually listen to right of center podcasts. The thing that I'm proudest of that I can do is I can actually totally play J.D. Vance right now and perfectly articulate his POV. I could get, like, 90% over there. I could articulate Bernie right now, but even though I disagree with both of them on the big policy questions, like, I work really, really, really hard to understand where they're coming from, their POV, and I take them in good faith. That's why I've come to the answers that I've come to. So that's something people really, really need to do, and no one does enough of.
So a shock collar or spray bottle for if you say MAGA, no, slap on the hand. And then listening to right podcasts, but being aware that you might like what you hear. So don't radicalize yourself over there. All right, perfect. Marshall, you're amazing and so enjoyed this. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.